Brant from Champaign-Danville Overhead Doors, offering pinch-proof doors, keyless digital entries, and lifetime manufacturer's warranties. Champaign-Danville Overhead Doors, serving businesses and families with professionally installed doors and automatic openers since 1959 in Ogden, Illinois. Today's programming is made possible by Dahlke Archive Press, a nonprofit literary press dedicated to publishing works in translation from around the world, including novels by Gustave Flaubert, Carlos Fuentes, Annie Ernaux, and Danilo Kish, located on the web at dahlkearchive.com, dahlkeyarchive.com.
This is the Afternoon Magazine on WILL AM 580. Celeste Quinn is away. I'm Tom Rogers. In 2001, the Wall Street Journal asked journalist Yaroslav Trofimov to report on the Muslim world, and it is a gigantic world with an area of influence reaching from Eastern Europe to Africa to the Far East. Its center, both in influence and culture, is, of course, the Middle East, and the last 4 years have seen enormous turmoil there, turmoil where America features prominently with invasions of Afghanistan and Iraq, and its involvement and relations with the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, Saudi Arabia, and other nations. Trofimov wanted to give Western readers in a post-September 11th world a glimpse of daily life and opinion in a range of majority Muslim countries, including Iraq, where he covered the U.S. invasion of 2003 and has frequently followed up there in the past 2 years. He wrote a book of his impressions called Faith at War, A Journey on the Front Lines of Islam from Baghdad to Timbuktu. He speaks with those who represent both moderate and more fundamentalist views, from government officials to clerics to common people, including his own assistants and government minders. And his book gives us a rarely seen perspective of the Muslim world. Your questions are welcome for Yaroslav Trofimov as well. Join us in the conversation. Our numbers are 333-9455 in the Champaign-Urbana area. Outside the local calling area, 1-800-222-9455, toll free, 333-WILL, 1-800-222-WILL. Yaroslav Trofimov, thanks for joining us, and good afternoon.
Good afternoon. It's great to be in the show.
Where are you speaking from today?
I'm in New York City.
Okay. And how did you develop an interest in covering the Muslim world?
Well, I used to live in Jerusalem and cover the Middle East from there back in the 1990s during the Oslo peace process. And I stopped doing that and went back to Europe. But on the week of September the 11th, I was asked by the Wall Street Journal to return to the area using my knowledge of Arabic and to report on what the Muslims are feeling about the U.S. and the U.S. policies in the wake of that tragedy. And I was on the road ever since.
And to try to get the Muslim world's impression, it is true that Islam is the largest religion in terms of the number of adherents. Is that correct?
Well, there is a bit of a dispute whether it's Christianity or Islam, but it's certainly one of the biggest two religions in the world. There is well over a billion Muslims in a universe that stretches from West Africa all the way to the Pacific shores of Indonesia.
So it would be hard to find just one Muslim response, obviously, I guess.
Of course, of course. And the diversity of views out there is stunning. But I think that, on the other hand, there was a unifying thread that ran through so many of these places. And that's a realization as the years continued that what for us had started in the West as war and terrorism is increasingly seen by many Muslims in many of these countries across the region as the world in Islam itself. And that's very tragic because this heralds very unfortunate developments in the future.
What is it that leads to that, you think? I mean, obviously, on one level, it's because when you are attacked, you feel it is a war on you.
Well, it all started with a very unfortunate use of the word crusades by President Bush in the very, very early on, very early days after 9/11. But then there were lots of other things that reinforced that sense of conspiracy theories that was always out there in the Middle East. It's natural in societies that are always, very often not democratic for conspiracy theories to flourish. And things like Abu Ghraib, these famous pictures of torturing Iraqi prisoners in Iraq that were broadcast all over the TV screens in the Muslim world. Things like reports from the Guantanamo Bay and just the visuals of the U.S. military action in Iraq, which has blended seamlessly on Arab news screens, television screens, with the pictures from the West Bank and Gaza. So no distinction is made anymore between the Israeli occupation or the Iraqi occupation, the American occupation in Iraq. So all of that has reinforced that sense of grievance in the Muslim world and has strengthened the radicals and the fanatics, because what we see now, 4 years after 9/11, is that our potential allies in the Muslim world, the liberals and the moderates and the Democrats, are afraid of us. They don't want to be publicly associated with the U.S. And any open American support for the moderates in the Muslim world is a kiss of death for them, because it strips them of their credibility among the Muslims themselves. And that's really bad news for us.
You were able to speak to some of the people that you mentioned as radicals, I guess. One one cleric, I noticed the irony in that in your trip to Saudi Arabia, you managed to speak to one of the clerics of the Wahhabi faith in one of the palaces, and it happened to be behind a Chuck E. Cheese. It seems that there is a strange combination of adherence or the likes of American culture with the feeling that America is somehow evil.
There is this widespread penetration of the material American culture, of the McDonald's and Chuck E. Cheese's and even of Hollywood movies, which should not be mistaken for the adoption of actual principles that govern American or Western society in general. And for me, it was very eye-opening in Cairo in the very first days after 9/11. I landed there. It was still the week of the attacks. And initially, I headed to a very poor neighborhood where the Islamist fundamentalism ran strong, and tried to talk to people to find out what they felt about the attacks. And there, to my surprise, the poor people, you know, very many of them, very outwardly religious with long beards, were sympathetic with the plight, with the American plight. They were saying it's horrible that children have died and it's horrible that those things have happened. But then I went to a McDonald's in Cairo, and the McDonald's in places like Egypt is where the wealthy go. That particular one was sandwiched between a Rolex watch outlet and a BMW car dealership. And there all these young, yuppified, if you will, Egyptians wearing American jeans and smoking American cigarettes were celebrating. They were holding a party, saying things like, "What a wonderful news! I hope there were lots of Jews in that building that went down." And so, you know, these people who should be our natural allies in the Muslim world, the Westernized young elites, are often the ones that hold the most radical, the most uncompromising positions.
Which is kind of interesting, because conventional wisdom has held before that, you know, radicalism stems from poverty.
Well, I think the opposite is the truth. In my personal experiences, and the experiences of many others who have studied the terrorist phenomenon, it's not the poor who become terrorists. It's the upper middle classes. And if you look at the leaders of Al-Qaeda, I mean, they didn't come from poor backgrounds. Osama bin Laden was born into a billionaire family. Ayman al-Zawahiri, you know, the number two in Al-Qaeda, he came from the Egyptian elites. He was a doctor. And so many of these other people, such as Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, the man who actually planned the 9/11, they spent years living in the West. Khalid Sheikh Mohammed was a student in the U.S. for almost 4 years. So these are people who know the West pretty well, and that's really scary. That actually people who know us best often are the ones who hate us most.
What is it that spurs that on, then, you think?
It's I think there are several reasons. First of all, once you are at a certain sort of level of financial wealth and education, you are much more interested in politics, because you don't have to worry about your daily survival, so you have time to think about other things. Also, it's the upwardly mobile people who come up against discrimination and racism and prejudice much more than people who are stationary. You know, if you are just a poor peasant, you know, you have no contact with Westerners. You know, there is no way, you know, you can be slurred, you can be called names, which is just simply ignored. If you are an Arab student in the U.S., you know, you might experience firsthand some prejudice. Remember that the founding father of the jihadi ideology, Said Qutb, an Egyptian writer, who's really sort of the Lenin of jihadism. He came up with this ideology while he was a student in Greeley, Colorado, in 1949. He wrote a book about that experience, which wasn't pleasant for him. He wrote in the book that because he was dark skinned, he was mistreated, and that really gave rise to this marriage of anti-Americanism with radical Islam.
There may be a difference. Is there a difference really between there is a difference, I guess, between political Islam, a broader term, and radical Islam? There are Islamist governments that may not have the same kind of radical characteristics.
Yeah, absolutely. The Islam as such, as a religion, is no more dangerous than any other religion. It's the political ideology of political Islam that is really driving this violence. And that's an ideology that was born in a very specific period in history. It was born in the 1930s. At the time when communism and Nazism were dominating Europe, and this was the Muslim world's equivalent to it, if you will. And it's based on the purity of religion, just as communism was based on the purity of class and Nazism on the purity of race. So it's a very 20th century modern ideology. Now, if you look at the Wahhabism in Saudi Arabia, up until recently, the Wahhabis were very quietist. I mean, they were content with enforcing very strict religious rules inside Saudi Arabia itself, but there was no political activism from them. It's only in the 1980s and 1990s when this Wahhabi tradition was married with the teachings of the Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt, which is, you know, this font of political Islam, that the new jihadists ideology of the bin Ladens was born. And you know, it's interesting to see that one of the two clerics that had the biggest influence on bin Laden, Salman al-Awda in Saudi Arabia, he was taught Islam by the brother of Sayyid Qutb, that founding father of the Egyptian jihadi ideology. So there's a very direct link from the 1930s political Islam ideology in Egypt to the Wahhabist heartland in Saudi Arabia, and then on to the worldwide al-Qaeda movement.
And interestingly, there's a conflict that's developed that involves the Saudi royal family, which goes back to that the Wahhabi the tradition. Mm-hmm. Yet now they face challenges, I guess, from that same kind of radical thought.
Well, they do because they have spent billions of dollars propping up the Wahhabi establishment, thinking that it's a loyal instrument of the state. But now that establishment, being infiltrated by the political Islamist ideology of the Brotherhood in Egypt and others, has become independent and is asking for more and more authority, and parts of it have become violent and fueling groups like Al-Qaeda. So it is a very big problem for them. But there hasn't been a clean break yet, because it's interesting to look at Saudi Arabia and to see that while there have been terror attacks there, nobody has tried to target the royal family directly yet. So there hasn't been a clean break yet. The royal family, as such, is not yet seen as an enemy by this movement.
You mentioned the chain of succession, which is very unique among monarchies, I guess, that the Saud family succeeds in a different way. What is the status of the royal family now? And if I'm not mistaken, was the book written after or before the death of King Fahd?
The book was written before the death of King Fahd, okay. But the system was set. System succession was set, and then the actual personalities were named in the mid 1990s,
right,
when Fahd had his stroke. So the actual power of running the country was transferred to Crown Prince Abdullah, who is now the king. The system works this way. The founding father of the Saudi kingdom, and one must remember it's a very recent creation, the Saudi kingdom, King Abdulaziz, ruled in the 1930s and 1940s. And he had many, many sons, because he would, Muslim law allows you to have four wives at a time. So what he would do, he would divorce his fourth wife every few weeks and marry another one. This way he would solidify links of marriage and bonding with various tribes in the area. So he had hundreds of children. And all the other kings in Saudi Arabia so far have been his sons. And they're all brothers. King Fahd is the brother of his predecessor, King Khaled, King Faisal before him, King Abdullah now, and the next in line is his younger brother, Prince Sultan, who is also in his late 70s. And the next in line is Prince Naif, who is also in his late 70s. So it's unlikely that any younger blood will come to the throne in the foreseeable future.
Does that make for a relatively unstable government then? The fact that you're talking about one generation that may be gone in a number of years?
Well, it's one generation governing for almost a century. It's not so much unstable as dysfunctional, because the people at the top of the government there, the top princes, they're all ministers. You know, Crown Prince Abdullah was in charge of the National Guard, which is the Praetorian security force. The next in line, Prince Sultan, was Minister of Defense and Aviation. And the next in line, Prince Nayef, was Minister of Interior and sort of Chief Information Officer for controlling all the censorship of the media. So, and they have been in those positions for 20, 30 years, which means that the entire ministries under them are basically private empires. So, you know, one of them controls the army, the other one of them controls the National Guard, the third controls the police. And all the officers there, they don't respond to the national government. They respond to the particular prince who has been running those ministries as his private domain for 30, 20, 40 years.
There are, besides Saudi Arabia, there are other governments in that region, such as Yemen and Kuwait, who have solid relations, or stable relationships, I guess, with the U.S. How does that play into their stability?
Well, Yemen is an interesting case because Yemen was playing on two tables, if you want. Because on one hand, it was claiming to have good relations with the U.S., but also Yemen had a civil war in the 1990s in which the winning party, the one that is in power now, won because it called on all the jihadis, the veterans of the Afghan jihad, to come to Yemen and help them. And so they had a debt to all these people. So they gave refuge to lots of very nasty characters who later surfaced in Afghanistan and elsewhere, attacking U.S. interests. And, you know, you must remember that before 9/11, in the year 2000, a U.S. Navy ship was destroyed in Yemen, and the people who were responsible for this were never quite found, and the FBI had very serious reservations about the level of cooperation they have received from the Yemenis. Now, after 9/11, and I was in Yemen just a few weeks after 9/11, people there in the government were very scared that Yemen would be bombed, would be the next on the target list after Afghanistan. So they changed the policy 180 degrees, and suddenly cooperation resumed and arrests started to happen. But still, they were just doing the minimum necessary to show their good faith to the U.S. But then the terrorists there started attacking Yemen's own interests. Later in that year, they sank a French oil tanker that was carrying oil from Yemen. And that really hurt the finances of Yemen itself. So following that, they did give the U.S. free rein, and the U.S. has been using unmanned drones flying over Yemeni territory to fire missiles at Yemenis with full permission of the Yemeni authorities.
Which I'm sure made Yemen a very uneasy place for you to visit when you did at that time.
Well, Yemen is always a very uneasy place to visit for foreigners especially. Mm-hmm. And I had an interesting experience there. You know, I was there at the time when people were thinking that Yemen would be attacked. So I was, and I had just spent a week aboard a U.S. aircraft carrier that was bombing Afghanistan in October 2001. So I went to a mosque in Sana'a where all these jihadi preachers were congregating to listen to the Friday sermon, which is the main sermon of the week. And the mullah was saying things like, God bless Osama bin Laden and, you know, God destroy America. So I was sitting in my car taking notes very quietly. As I noticed this crowd massing around me, surrounding the car, and one of the men started pointing at me and spitting at the car and screaming, you're an American spy pointing airstrikes against our mosque. And it took a lot of persuasion to get out of that fix.
It's got to be nearly impossible as somebody with American ties, at the very least, although you carry an Italian passport, to report in that region at any time, especially, you know, between September 11th and now.
Well, it's getting worse and worse. In the beginning, people in lots of places, even in Iraq, were making a huge distinction between American soldiers and Western soldiers, because there are also Italian troops there, and Western journalists. I remember going everywhere in Iraq in the first 6 months after the war and feeling fairly safe, you know, even talking to insurgents, because they were not targeting us journalists back then. But as the conflict intensified and there was more and more bloodshed, and with things like the assault on Fallujah, things changed. So no Westerner is safe in Iraq now, there are no exceptions made for us journalists. And that's a very weird situation, because being reporters. We're used to being sort of neutral observers above the parties. You know, you know, he said and she said, and you know, one side says this, that one side says that. Well, we cannot work this way because the other side doesn't talk to us, doesn't say things, it just kills us. So it actually changes the way you operate.
Right. This is we're talking with Yaroslav Shafromov, a reporter for The Wall Street Journal, the author of the book Faith at War, A Journey on the Front Lines of Islam from Baghdad to Timbuktu. You can join the conversation. Your questions for Yaroslav Shafromov are very welcome. 333-9455 in Champaign-Urbana, elsewhere 1-800-222-9455. You mentioned, you know, the safety, your personal safety obviously plays a factor in the kind of reporting you can do. And that's, I guess, where the controversial concept of embedding with the troops had come in. You were also embedded at one point with the U.S.
I was not embedded during the invasion itself because, I mean, my primary interest was not to describe the sort of the bang of the combat, but to try to understand what the Iraqis in the very, very first days of the war were feeling about the U.S. So what I did, I just drove a big SUV across the border following the tanks, but on my own. And drove to Baghdad. Basically, you know, I had enough jerry cans of fuel strapped to the roof, and enough water and food to last me to Baghdad and back.
An SUV is not quite a tank.
It's not quite a tank. It was a very brand new Yukon that I rented from Hertz without telling them I'm intending to take it to the war zone. And you know, it survived. You know, but looking at it in retrospect, of course, it was quite foolhardy because any stray bullet hitting those jerry cans would have turned it into a giant fireball. But I did embed later on because it was once the actual occupation started. It was very interesting for me to spend some time with troops in various parts of Iraq and to see this very uneasy interaction. Because once the actual task of the troops was no longer to shoot other soldiers, but to try to run the country. It was fascinating to observe them trying to do that, and it was very, very hard for them because, you know, they were trained for conventional war, not for a military occupation. And you know, there were 20-year-old lieutenants sent to run cities of 100,000 residents, and then some of them did the job pretty well.
And that's how some of the bad blood, or you know, things have gotten more tense between regular Iraqis and the U.S. troops.
Well, of course. Nobody likes to be occupied by a foreign power, especially if it's a military force like the U.S. military that is putting an enormous premium on operational security, which means on not getting its own troops killed. And unlike other military units in Iraq, unlike the British, for example, the U.S. has rules of engagement that allow soldiers to shoot at Iraqis, civilians or otherwise, at the mere suspicion that something might happen. And the soldiers are encouraged to do that. I mean, they're told that, you know, it doesn't matter if the guy you shot had a weapon. Even if you thought he might have had a weapon, that's enough. I mean, just your thought is justification for killing him. And long term, this backfires because it might protect the security of that particular soldier on that day. But because it kills so many civilians and creates so many blood feuds, in a tradition that calls for revenge, it just spurs more attacks and long-term endangers the security of American soldiers there.
How do you as a reporter then try to get a pulse of everyday Iraqi life when, especially, you know, today, your job is, or your life is so much in danger by going out and doing just that very thing?
Well, I was last in Iraq in April and May this year. And it's very hard. It's very hard. You really have to plan every interview as a military mission. I mean, most European correspondents have left Iraq, so there's just just reporters for American and British newspapers who are left there, and news organizations that are left there. And we have to drive in an armored car. We have a car with armed guards that follows us, and the rules are, you know, don't stay in anybody's house for more than half an hour, 40 minutes, because that's the time it takes to organize a kidnapping. And colleagues of mine have spent almost a year without ever walking on the streets of Europe because just, you know, getting out of the car and walking on the main street is you know, it's like to get killed within the next 10 minutes.
Yet you still need to find those sources out there.
So there is a lot of work that goes into, you know, sending out our Iraqi assistants to go and to organize interviews, to convince people to talk to us and maybe talk to them on some neutral ground in a hotel that is protected. So it's so much more effort goes into the logistics of meeting someone.
You spend a good amount of time talking about those assistants and how they put themselves at risk as well, some of the people that help you arrange those interviews, interpret. How do you find them, first of all?
Well, the assistant that I found in Iraq was just on the street. Yeah. It was I had just arrived in Baghdad. It was 2 days after the fall of Baghdad. And there was this woman standing outside the Palestine Hotel and all dressed up. You know, she was about 50 years old. And she was a university professor of English. She was just curious. She wanted to see who are these foreigners who came to rule her country. And she led me to her house, and her husband, cooked fish and then kebab for me. And she told me she'd love to help me around, to introduce me to people. And she ended up working for us for almost a year, until it became so dangerous for her to do that. And they have received threats like many others, and so it was thought to be prudent for them to stop working for us, unfortunately.
What goes through their minds? Do they try to maintain sort of the same unbiased opinions as the reporters they help, or do you get the same kind of opinions from them that may be out in the streets?
Well, I mean, just the mere act of going out to work for a foreign news organization is taking a position, because it means you are accepting the coexistence with the Westerners, and instead of thinking that war is the only way, you try to help them to understand your country. So already the group that goes to work with us reporters is sort of self-selected politically. But most of them, just like the rest of the Iraqis, have very negative opinions about the occupation by now. And these opinions have changed, because I could see it with my own assistants, who in the beginning were quite open and welcoming of the invasion. But as they had more and more interactions with soldiers, as we did, I mean, our car was pushed off the road by a U.S. convoy without warning. Because the U.S. convoy just saw an Iraqi car and were scared of us. And going through that sort of experience would turn anyone against the occupation forces.
That was one of the most interesting parts of the book, to see that gradual change in opinion among your assistants, just in the wake of the invasion and for the months following that.
Yes, absolutely, and that's a change that's mirrored by other Iraqis. And my assistants thankfully did not have the really bad experiences. I mean, none of their family was shot or wounded or otherwise injured. So, but thousands and thousands of other Iraqis, have had family members killed by the U.S. troops in years after the war. And the estimates of the number of the Iraqi civilians killed by U.S. troops in the last 2 years, range from 20,000 to almost 100,000. And there are no official statistics because, as the U.S. military spokesman always say, we don't count their bodies.
This is Yaroslav Trofimov. We're talking with a reporter from the Wall Street Journal on the subject of the Muslim world and how their attitudes of the United States and the West have changed in the 4 years. His book is called Faith at War. You can give us a call at 333-9455 or 1-800-222-9455 to join in the conversation. You visited also countries that to the U.S. don't seem like hotbeds of political controversy. Tunisia is one place that you visited, as well as Iraq's and Afghanistan's of the world. What makes Tunisia interesting as far as the attitudes that they have as opposed to the rest of the Muslim world?
Tunisia, I think, is a fascinating, absolutely fascinating example of what we want from the Muslim world and how our desires sometimes can backfire, because Tunisia is a country that is probably the most secular in the Muslim world. And there is a tendency to think that if a country is secular, then there is no radicalism there politically. So the government in Tunisia, for example, has adopted laws that give women more rights than anywhere else in the Muslim world, arguably in the U.S., because abortion is available for everyone without any questions asked. And there is full equality in law and in practice between men and women. Religion is very strictly controlled. So it's a secular paradise, but like most other countries in the Muslim world, it is a dictatorship as well. and the government is as just as repressive as the Saudi regime as far as torture and treatment of political prisoners goes. And so there's a paradox that, you know, we are supporting that dictatorship because it happens to be secular, but by doing so, we're pushing all the liberals in that society into the hands of the underground Islamist opposition, possible terrorists. I had a very interesting conversation there with one of the leading human rights campaigners who's often beaten up by the police and then detained and harassed. And she's a very secular woman. And she was telling me it's a tragedy. But now, for us, wearing a veil is a symbol of human rights campaigning and of campaigning for democracy. And, you know, the state television, state media doesn't allow me to address my countrymen. So the only outlet she has is the satellite TV channel that is operating out of London and that is run by the Tunisian Islamists. So liberals and secularists that are opposed to the government in these countries have to go to the Islamists to get their message across. And that's so similar to what had happened in Iran back in the 1970s, because in Iran there was a secularist dictatorship, the Shah, that was supported by the U.S., and by doing so, we have pushed the liberals there into the hands of Ayatollah Khomeini and the Islamists. There was this alliance of the liberals and the socialists and the communists with Khomeini that swept away the Shah. But once the Islamists got the upper hand, then they proceeded very quickly to eliminate all the liberals and the communists.
You mentioned also that, you know, one of the more popular television stations in Tunisia was Al Manar, which is run by Hamas. Or was it Hamas or Hezbollah?
Hezbollah, yeah.
Hezbollah in Lebanon, another example. Yet, interestingly enough, you also were able to visit a Jewish community in Tunisia. There is still a Jewish community there.
There is still a Jewish community on the island of Jerba in Tunisia. And because the secularist sort of, you know, liberal and modern image is so important for Tunisia, because it gives it a blank check for repression against political opponents at home, the government in Egypt is very, very careful in maintaining and preserving the Jewish community and protecting it. It's a fairly big community. It's a very, very Orthodox community. And the leaders there told me that we don't want to go to Israel or to France because these are godless nations. It's just here in Tunisia that we can preserve these ancient traditions. And religious schools are banned in Tunisia, so Muslims cannot go to a religious Muslim school. But there is an exception made for the Jews on that island just because the government wants to go out of its way to show how tolerant it is. And, you know, it's very easy to be tolerant with a very small minority, but it's not so tolerant with the rest of the population.
Yeah, there's also a very well-known Muslim university in Tunisia as well, although... What's the relationship? What's the dynamic between, you know, the government there and that school?
Well, the oldest surviving Islamic university in the world is based in Tunisia. It's called Zaytuna. And what the government has done there is to completely transform this very old traditional school into something that propagates its own brand of Islam light, if you want, a stripped-down Islam that the government seeks to reconcile with modernity. And it's spending a lot of money to bring in students from around West Africa and the Balkans and other places in the Muslim world to teach them this modern version of Islam, which on its own is a very commendable undertaking. The problem is because it's done by a government that is so repressive and so intolerant of dissent, this message of tolerance doesn't quite have the same validity it would have had otherwise.
You spent also a considerable amount of time in Afghanistan after the invasion there as well, and unlike Iraq, there have been elections in both Iraq and Afghanistan. I think people seem to point to Afghanistan as having a bit more successful start at trying to form a democracy. Though you mentioned that there are cracks in those seams as well.
Well, Afghanistan is not a success story, but. Mm-hmm. Taken on its own. I mean, it's a country where violence is increasing. I mean, so more people will have been killed by the end of this year than were killed last year. And last year, well over 1,000 people were killed. And if you are an American soldier in Afghanistan, your chances of being killed are pretty much the same in proportion to the number of troops as they are in Iraq. But still, it's not unraveling as Iraq is. And what we are seeing in Afghanistan would be by far the best case desirable scenario for Iraq. And the reason why Afghanistan is still holding, relatively speaking, is that the U.S. policy there was much, much wiser than it was in Iraq. there was a lot of respect paid to the local traditions and to the local way of doing things. There was a big effort not to insult gratuitously and not to alienate the local population. And this whole effort was led by Ambassador Talmai Halilzad, the American ambassador to Afghanistan until recently, who was himself born in Afghanistan. So you had the top man exercising U.S. policy there, who spoke the language, knew the culture, and didn't make the mistakes that were so frequent in Iraq. In Iraq, we saw the opposite. Ambassador Bremer, the head of the occupation authority, was not born in Iraq. He did not speak Arabic. He did not know much about the Arab world until he got to Iraq. And there were so many needless errors made there that made things worse. And I think it may seem, a minor point to us, but in countries that take so much value in pride and local nationalism, for an Afghan to see that the Americans are doing something in Iraq, in Afghanistan, was acceptable because the public face of America there was, local boy made good, Ambassador Halilzad. So that was taking, they could take pride in American achievements there anyway. In Iraq, there was the opposite. So even the good things, even the improvements that the U.S. have made in Iraq were rejected because this is something the foreigners have done, they imposed on us, without ever asking us, what do we want?
And that ambassador, I believe, has been transferred to Iraq, is that correct?
Well, he has been transferred to Iraq, but again, he's an Afghan, he's not an Iraqi. So I don't think the very same magic will work in Iraq because Iraqis, tend to view Afghans as complete foreigners, and they think that the Iraqis are much more superior in their culture to Afghans. So I don't know how this chemistry will work there.
We have a call on line 4 in Eureka. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. I've only partially followed your guest. It's very interesting. The question is the Arabic news agency. The name it escapes me. Could you give a website and/or is any of their information available in any shortwave broadcasting service to North America in English, to your knowledge?
Well, there are a lot of Arabic news agencies.
I mean, the one you were just talking about, the one that seems to give a more that the American government that's very displeased with.
Well, the best known TV channel, Al Jazeera.
Yes, that's what I'm talking about.
Yeah, Al Jazeera actually has a website in English. I don't remember the actual URL off the top of my head, mm-hmm. but I'm sure you can Google it and find it.
I see. What is the spelling of that, please?
J-A-Z-E-E-R-A.
J-A-Z-E-E-R-A?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And there's no service that broadcasts any of their news to North American English?
That I'm unaware of.
Do you know? Okay. Thank you very much.
Thanks for your call. You do see a great diversity of programming or of coverage of the Middle East between the Arabic channels, like you mentioned, some of which are available in English, and Western journalists. How well is the media in the West interpreting the Iraqi situation, the Afghanistan situation, and the attitudes of people there today, do you think?
Well, the focus is understandably different. I mean, the American media, especially, and the Western media in general, we look at what our boys are doing mm-hmm. there. It's natural. I mean, you want to see what American troops are doing. So the focus is a lot on what our people are doing there. The Arab media focus on what is being done to their people by our people. And so, if you looked at the invasion of and the storming of Fallujah last year, if you looked on CNN, you would find reports from journalists embedded with American troops, showing American soldiers shooting. What you would see in Al Jazeera from reporters in Fallujah would, be the receiving end of those bombs and bullets. So the perspective is very different.
You mentioned circumstances that the were just the pictures from Abu Ghraib, and as you mentioned, the bombings on some or in the area of religious sites in Iraq changed the mindset of people gradually, as people that you may have considered moderate, I guess. Is there a way for that mindset to change back, you think? Can America, the government change things at all? Change mindsets?
Well, I think the only way to change mindsets is by changing the reality. I think no amount of public diplomacy or sending, you know, senior officials on propaganda tours in the region will change the very skeptical and very cynical view of America that is omnipresent in the Muslim world. Concrete steps, concrete things like pushing towards more democracy, actually doing it in places like Egypt or Saudi Arabia, would help. And you know, some things have helped. In Iraq, for example, the U.S., despite initial opposition to the elections, did allow elections to happen earlier this year. I mean, if you remember the plans of the occupation authority from early 2004, they called for no elections. The idea was to create an Iraqi parliament by handpicking through a system of caucuses a number of compliant local notables. And it took huge demonstrations by Shiite religious parties and you know, a lot of violence by people like the Muqtada al-Sadr movement to force the American hand and to do call for elections. But, you know, once it has happened, that has pacified lots of Shiites. And you can see that the Shiite areas of Iraq are relatively peaceful now, more peaceful than were a year and a half ago.
There are many leaders, though, with fairly large followings who say that democracy is un-Islamic.
Well, people say that democracy is un-Islamic, but I think giving, as we have seen in Iraq and Afghanistan, giving the opportunities most people like to go and vote. And, you know, the turnout in elections in both Iraq and Afghanistan was huge. It was huge even by, you know, people, fewer people, a smaller proportion of people in the U.S. goes to vote than the ones who went there, in presidential elections in the U.S. at least. So that's very encouraging.
We have a call for Yaroslav Chofromov on line 4 in Kingman, Indiana. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. So the $64,000 question is, how do we save face and get ourselves out of Iraq? And I'll listen off the air. Thank you.
The safe face part is something I tried circuitously to ask, I guess, earlier. But it is the question, I guess.
Well, it is the question, and the tragedy is that I don't think there is an answer to this now. Because if the U.S. were to withdraw from Iraq precipitously, the most likely scenario would be a civil war there, in which I am not at all convinced that the Sunnis, despite being a minority, will lose, because the Sunnis are much better trained militarily than the Shiites, and they will have the backing of the rest of the Arab world. So are we prepared to see in much of Iraq a Taliban-like state that would have access to oil and would be right smack in the center of the Middle East, not in the mountains of the Hindu Kush, and ready to give shelter to anyone who wants to attack America? I mean, withdrawing from Iraq now would bring us back to September the 10th, 2001, except in much more weakened state and without friends. So the quandary is very, very difficult.
One place that you do go to where democracy is being practiced apparently is the nation of Mali in Central Africa, which is also a place where when people think of Islam, it's not the first nation or even area that comes to mind. How does democracy work in that area, and what do people think of the government that's set up there?
Mali is a fascinating example, and I stumbled upon it because I was really getting desperate about the situation in the Muslim world and looking at the big question, why is there no democracy there? So there is a New York think tank, Freedom House, that ranks countries in the world based on their political freedoms and individual liberties. And only two countries in the entire Muslim world, among more than 40, are ranked as fully free. And both of them are in West Africa. It's Mali and Senegal. So I went to Mali to look at elections there. I went all the way to Timbuktu, this mythical city in the Sahara Desert. And it was remarkable. It's one of the poorest countries on Earth. But the process that people seem to understand so intuitively and so well is exactly the same one we have here in the U.S. or in Europe when elections are held. It was nice and free and open debate. And I think the reason behind this, though, is that Islam there, unlike in many other places, has stayed as a religion. I mean, there is a very clear separation of church and state. And so Islamic clerics are not meddling in politics. I went to talk to one of the Islamic leaders in Timbuktu, and he said, look, all the candidates come to my house and they ask for blessings. So I say a prayer and I bless them all, and I endorse none of them. And that's really the secret of their success.
Is there a danger that attitude can change over time?
Absolutely. There is danger, and there is lots of money from Saudi Arabia and Libya that is being poured in these countries in West Africa to try to Islamicize them more and to bring them into the same mold as the rest of the Muslim world is.
Another piece of evidence of that you mentioned was when you visited Bosnia-Herzegovina, which is the one Islamic country in Europe, majority Islamic country, where there has been a great revival of religious places in the wake of the civil war there, yet a lot of it has been financed by Saudi Arabia.
Yeah, well, it's just to correct you, Bosnia is not the only Islamic country. There is also Albania. And one can argue Turkey is partially in Europe.
Oh, yeah,
but there was a big revival of religious fundamentals, which was virtually non-existent during and before the war, by the Saudis, because as the international administrator for Bosnia told me, we, the Westerners, were building schools and hospitals, and you know, we let the Saudis build mosques. And there were plenty of brand-new mosques built around there. And but it's not just that. I think also the things like the war in Iraq has changed minds there as well. I had this conversation with the leader of the Boston Muslims, a very moderate man who has a PhD from the University of Chicago. And he told me, look, when the war in Iraq started, we went out to all the mosques and said, we oppose the war as Muslims, but don't make the mistake of seeing this through the prison of religion. Don't make the mistake of thinking that this is a conflict of civilizations between Christianity and Islam. This is just a political issue out there in the Middle East, far away from us. But after seeing Abu Ghraib, after seeing the pictures from Fallujah and Najaf, the bombings, and the suffering of ordinary Iraqis, people have changed their mind, he said. And he said that now he no longer can preach the same message because people now do think that this is a clash of civilizations. And surprisingly, there are young Bosnian Muslims living in the most European, the most probably westernized Muslim country in the world, that go off to Iraq to fight with the jihadis against Americans. And this is in a country that was saved from genocide by an American intervention 10 years earlier.
You wrap up the book with a quote from a cleric in Bosnia mentioning that he doesn't think we have a safer world now than before. And his quote to end the book is, "This is now out of our control." Is it really out of control, you think?
It certainly looks like. It's hard to see how things will get better in the short term. I mean, nobody knows what will happen, 5 or 10 years down the line. But I think we're in for a long haul for now.
Yaroslav Trofimov is the author of the book Faith at War. Thanks for joining us this afternoon.
Great to be on the show.
And good luck where your next assignment takes you.
Thank you.
Yaroslav Trofimov spoke to us from New York. His book, Faith at War, A Journey on the Front Lines of Islam from Baghdad to Timbuktu, is published by Henry Holt & Company. It's 1:54, 6 minutes before 2 o'clock, and settlement prices are now in from the Chicago Board of Trade. And with those numbers, here's Todd Gleason.
Thanks much, Tom. From the Chicago Board of Trade on this Monday afternoon, futures across the grains floor and oil seeds finished the day lower. We'll talk about that a little bit this afternoon during the closing market report. 6 after the hour, 2 o'clock, not too terribly far away, we'll talk with Kurt Kimmel of Grainfield Marketing out of Normal, Illinois. If you're a producer, a farmer, and you've been watching the natural gas prices and wondering about your anhydrous ammonia and what kind of impact that may have on the price of nitrogen, we'll take that issue up a bit today, as well as we did on Commodity Week over the weekend. You can pick that whole program up for Commodity Week at will.uiuc.edu. Just click on AM, then Agriculture. That's the Ag homepage. Scroll down and you'll find Commodity Week. Probably worth listening to. Our guest, by the way, was Mark Russo, who is with Chesapeake Energy, and Mark or his cohort will be on again this afternoon. We'll take up more a little bit about natural gas and supplies. They follow the natural gas area and work with companies closely on positioning natural gas supplies and how to explore for it and how the weather impacts it. But have a good idea about how those supplies are used, where they are positioned, and what it all might mean for the price of nitrogen, which is a primary food nutrient for corn and soybeans and wheat. Soybeans, of course, fix its own nitrogen, but corn and wheat need nitrogen fertilizer supplied, and that helps out a great deal, and the price of natural gas is related to nitrogen, and we'll talk about that this afternoon during the closing market report. Now that I've rattled on, we had a talk a little bit about the prices at the Chicago Board of Trade. Speaking of wheat, December futures were down 4.25 today at the Board of Trade for the soft red winter wheat contract. 332.5 the high, the low at 327.5, and a settlement price there at 3.29¼ for the day. March contract down 4 cents, 3.44. The settlement price, the high at 46.5, the low at 41.5. December corn futures for the day, a 2.06¾ high, low at 2.04¼. Settlement price at 2.04.5, and they were down 2¾. March futures, 2.17¼. The settlement, that high price at 2.19¼, the low at 2.17. And the March corn futures settled at 2.17¼. They were down 2¼. May contract, a 2.26¼ high, low at 2.24.5. Settled at $2.24¾. They were off 2.5 cents. And July futures, 2.32½, the high, the low at 2.30½. Settlement price there, 2.30¾, down 2.5 cents. September contract, 2.38½, the high, the low at 37¼. Settlement price at $2.37¼ for the September corn, down 2¼. September wheat futures, 3.63, the high, the low at 3.60. Settlement price at 3.62. They were off 5.5 cents for the day. Well, I skipped right from the corn back to the wheat. Dave Dickey's sitting here listening to me. He's not smiling about that yet, but let's go back. September corn, I gave you December corn for next year, 2.47¾, the high. The low at 2.46, settlement price at 2.46. That was down 2.5. December oats, 1.61¼, the high. The low at 1.58½. And the oat pits settled the December contract, 1.59½. They were down 1¼. March futures at 1.65¾, down 1¼. November beans, 5.72½, the high, the low at 5.66. Settlement price at $5.67½. They were off 6.5 cents today. January soybeans off 6¼, 5.76¼. Settlement price there, the high at 82, the low at 75 even. March futures at 5.89, high, low at 5.83. Settlement price at 5.84¼. They were down 6¼. And the May soybeans at 5.94, high, low at 5.88½. Settlement price at 5.89¼, down 6¾. And the August futures, 5.90½. They were down 6.5 cents. October bean meal, 169.70. A settlement price down 160. The high at 171.80 and the low at 169.50. The December contract down $1.80 at 172.40. October bean oil, 22.88. The high, the low at 22.43. Settlement price at 22.67. They were off 21. And December oil down 21 at 22.94. Now here's Tom Rogers with the Mercantile Exchange numbers. Tom?
And we go to the Merc, where we have down day for feeder cattle, up day for live cattle, and sort of mixed for hogs. Feeder cattle for September, the high today, 115.80, the low 115.40, settled at the high 115.80, unchanged for the day. October feeders, the high 114.30, the low 113.42½, the settlement 113.95, down 2.5. And November feeder cattle, the high 113.60, the low 112.65, settlement at 113.37½, down 7.5 points. October live cattle today had a high of 87.37½, the low 86.30, settled at 87.22½.